Just a bit of a forewarning before the podcast begins. This is during the editing post, and we've had a bit of an issue with Matt's mic in this. It was an error with the actual recording itself and not with the editing process at all. So I've tried to mitigate it, but there are some cutouts that I just can't fix outside of literally just recording him saying a word so I can cut and paste it in. Rest of the podcast is fine, though. We've got everyone else here, which is wonderful. It's a good one. And I really do hope you enjoy it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mattcast, the uploaded podcast. But this week, we actually have three Matts on, which is going to be wonderfully confusing for the one person who's not a Matt. So I'm obviously Matt S, the editor-in-chief of digitallydownloaded.net. With me this week, we have regular Matt C from New Zealand. You'll recognize him from that awesome accent.
Hello.
That was beautiful.
That's the best worst Aussie accent ever. Well done, Matt. We have a special guest, Matt K, who's a game dev behind Mole Man Must Die, which is a really neat little game, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But he has a real Aussie accent.
Are you going?
That's it. And then we have Ginny, who's not a Matt, and you'll be able to recognize her voice by the fact she's also the only woman on the panel this week.
Yep, that's me.
Thanks everyone for coming on. We got plenty to talk about, and let's get on with it.
Bye.
And welcome back. That was our customary Hatsune Miku track as picked by Matt Kay, who is a fellow Miku fan. And Alan, wherever he is at the moment, is cursing the fact that we've actually got a podcast full of Miku fans this week. when we do that, because it does mean that we are going to talk about Hatsune Miku, which is great, and I like talking about Hatsune Miku. Reason to talk about her this week. There is an annual concert over in Japan. It takes place, it kind of ties in with Miku's birthday being the 31st of August and all that, and they do a big exhibition and concert series. It's really worth going to. It's worth, you know, organizing a trip to Japan to experience, because it is that good. And to get tickets, you kind of actually have to get them via a lottery system, because they're just so in demand. Not everybody that wants to get a ticket can get one. So yeah, they're running 5 concerts this year. You would hope that that would get you a ticket in one of them, but you do need to put your name down in the lottery if you want that chance. Then it ends up later this month. So with all that being all exciting and stuff, they've also revealed the kind of the artwork to go with the official official concert artwork, because they always dress Miku up in some new costume for these events and stuff. And yeah, we thought we'd talk about Miku and Miku concerts and whether you should go along to them. So Matt Kay, given that you are a relatively recent fan of Miku, like most people out west, if you had the chance.
Sorry, can you say that again? It just cut out then for a second.
Given that you're a fan of Miku, relatively recent fan though, would you go along to a concert if you had the chance?
Oh, I would love to. There's there was an event in Melbourne quite recently for another Vocaloid, and I have been completely shattered that I wasn't in town at the time. And
no.
You know, you see the concerts online, like, you know, I have them on quite a lot while I'm working, and they're phenomenal. Like, you know, as an arena show, you know, as just a performance in general, you know, they're really up there.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been to two the last 2 years since I kind of got Miku. I've made a thing to go each year, and yeah, it's really amazing just how live the whole experience kind of feels, like,
yeah, absolutely,
that you've got access to all the senses that you've got access to, you know, sight and sound and all of that kind of stuff. That really is like a real Miku up there on stage. Like, she's moving around in full 3D, she looks lifelike, it's just an amazing experience. And yeah, the tickets are like $90 this year to get good seats, and that puts them, you know, kind of in the same arena as, you know, any other rock concert, and more than happy to pay that.
I mean, like, if you know, like, getting over is always the tricky part, but you know, if it was you know, something like available here, like, I would be all over that in a heartbeat.
$90 seems a lot cheaper than I would have thought. I was imagining in the region of more like $200 to $300.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how the economy... I mean, concert in Australia probably wouldn't have the same size crowd, so you probably need to charge more to get people along to it. But yeah, in Japan, these halls, the hall that they're holding it in holds a good 6,000 to 8,000 people, I want to say. Maybe 8,000, maybe high. On the high end of that. And yeah, you can get the cheaper tickets out the back for, which is $80 roughly, or you can get the kind of the good tickets right up the front for 90, and that also gets you access to the exhibition, which is a really good thing to go to as well. Like, that in itself would be the size of, you know, something like PAX in Australia, the Miku exhibition, all focused around this character, and the lineups to get into that alone are like 3 hours long at the start of the day. It just, the lineup just stretches on and on. I think a lot of people in the West don't quite, but in Japan, they are more than sold on the whole Vocaloid thing, and where it might have once been kind of a hobby that not many people were kind of on board with, it's certainly, I'd say it's mainstream now for sure.
Yeah, I remember watching the Letterman appearance of Miku, and on one hand, he clearly did not get it, but on the other hand, I completely loved that it was on there. You know, it was almost like a victory moment in a lot of ways.
I think it's hilarious just how completely confused Letterman was by that. It's the most awkward bit of TV because he's just lost. He has no idea what's going on. It's hilarious. I mean, Ginny, obviously you're also a fan of Miku. What about Miku kind of appeals to you?
Well, I mean, apart from the very obvious anime girl package, which you guys already know at DDNet, I really enjoy. I actually have always just really enjoyed going to concerts. I mean, I used to get dragged to orchestra performances as a kid by my parents. We're really into that, you know, music is high art kind of stuff. But I guess when I was growing up, obviously I wasn't just, you know, sitting at home cracking out the Chopin every now and again. Like, I was watching anime, I was watching cartoons, and it's just Miku's music was always something that I found very uplifting in terms of like just being happy. Like, and also Miku, when I was younger and I got into her, let's say maybe around like 2010, 2011 probably was when I really started getting into Miku. It's just, she was always so happy, and obviously she's a program, you know, she doesn't really display, I would say, negative emotions unless she's singing a particularly moving song, and even then that's sort of just a very positive spin on a sad emotion. I just think that Miku has always been associated with happiness, with being upbeat for me, which is also why I enjoy shows like Love Live. And so a Miku concert would just be like an injection of like happiness into my veins, like straight up. Like, that is how I would feel if I was listening to her concert and seeing it live. And I mean, Miku, I think personally for me, is a bit like escapism. I mean, clearly she is a great synthetic singer, you know, all her concerts and her songs are very fantastically produced, they're very large productions. And I think that Miku to me is a bit like a fantasy figure. And so I would 100% shell out money to go and see her, because she's not just a singer at that point. Like, she's not really like, it's not really like going to see your favorite band in action. Like, Miku is a creation and she's very manufactured, but that's the appeal to me, that you can make something that is so happy and it can still be a creation, a product of man, but it can still inspire so much positive emotion in people. It can trigger like a realistic emotional response from humans, and that's what I really admire about Miku.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing that is so great about going to a Miku concert is, I mean, if you were to go to, you know, any other kind of artist, you get that artist's particular style. You go to, I don't know, Lady Gaga, you get Lady Gaga's music. You go to, you know, whatever rock concert, one style. But with Miku, because the music's actually created by, you know, effectively fans, and there's like 8,000 people out there who have actually created Miku music, the music that they actually pick for the song for the concerts goes through a whole range of different styles and approaches and even genres, and so you get such that great variety. And I mean, for me, Miku is the variety that she represents and the creativity that she enables. And, you know, whatever kind of mood you're in for, you're in, there's some kind of, you know, match that mood. So you go to a concert, you just get this great eclectic mix of different styles and different genres and different characterizations. And that's kind of really, really, and gives concerts a vibrancy that I don't think other concerts do. I must admit, I don't actually go to concerts as a thing, because they're kind of loud, and maybe I'm getting old, but I don't like the feeling walking out of a concert and not being able to hear anything for days afterwards. But I make an exception for Miku, because it's just it's interesting, and the whole sociology behind what makes people fans of Miku and why people would go along to concerts and the kind of the communities that build around Miku is all very interesting from an academic point of view as well.
No, I think it's really interesting that you highlight the almost like the crowdsourcing of all of Miku's songs, because it's very interesting. Like every time you see Miku presented to the West, like, you know, going back to like the that David Letterman appearance or whatever else, they keep trying to media keeps trying to talk about it as if it is another Taylor Swift or another Lady Gaga. Part of what is so fascinating about Miku is that everyone's sort of coming together under this one umbrella of personality to do all this really interesting creative stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I don't think the media in the West kind of gets it yet, say the least. When to other journalists and stuff about Miku, I kind of constantly have to keep explaining it, and that's to tech journalists, let alone the kind of the more general interest ones. It's not just the music either. Every costume that Miku wears in concerts and in the games and whatever is designed by fans. Everything that's in those games is designed by fans and then taken by Sega and pulled together into this one wonderful game. But all those costumes are fan designs. All the music is obviously written by fans. The actual choreography for all the dances that you see, again, it's all designed by fans. You can get the software for free. It's called Miku Miku Dance. And then you can go and create your own video clips for this character. So the actual role that Krypton, the company that created Miku, has in Miku is very limited. Krypton's actually only got like 30 people in the company. It's a tiny, tiny company. It's a tiny company, and they create very little beyond the actual base Miku. All the official costumes, the racy Mikus, the winter Mikus, and everything that that they kind of put on the figures and stuff, that's actually taken by fans. Krypton picks all thing, but also Krypton will curate what is going to be the official Miku designs and stuff. But again, they don't create it. It's almost all designed, by fans.
Just going back to what you're saying about people in the West, or journalists in particular, but people in general not really getting it. I think most people are still hung up on the idea of on arguing about whether or not Miku is real, which I find kind of laughable. And I just appreciate that we've been able to talk about her for about 20 minutes without having to clarify that, yes, she actually is real.
Well, I mean, that's a perception thing, and obviously I've written about that more than a couple of times in the past. about what is real and what is not real is a bit of a nonsense discussion when it comes to Miku, whether it is... it's hard to explain, but what you see in front of you is kind of real. Whether that happens to be animated or not is kind of irrelevant, really. Certainly people buy into vision of Miku, and everyone buys into that vision that they have of Miku, and that's no different to any other celebrity. I mean, I have my own idea about who Lady Gaga is. Lady Gaga isn't any more real in that sense to me than Miku is.
Like game dev or engineer me or, artist me or whatever, can see all the components that goes into making Miku. I can see all the bits and pieces that are in there from an engineering standpoint. But then you look at the live shows and you look at the audience like jumping up and down, and screaming and, waving their glow sticks and stuff. That's no different to the public persona, any number of pop stars present. So, I think absolutely it is a very real experience.
And I mean, in many ways, Miku is kind of the ultimate realization of a pop star because, you know, you might be a fan of, I don't know, let's pull a name out the hat. You might be a fan of Selena Gomez, for instance. And then Selena will go and do something very stupid because she seems to do a bit of that. And we're a fan of Serena Gomez. You know, her personality's kind of been ruined for you. Her celebrity is diminished. But Miku can never kind of let you down because she's never going to have, like, a controversy where she sleeps with Justin Bieber or... She's never going to go and say something stupid to the media or anything like that. Everything that Miku is your own interpretation of that character, and she can never let you down from that point of view. So in so many ways, that is kind of...
I mean, don't write off completely the idea of her sleeping with Justin Bieber, because, I mean, it could happen.
Yeah, I guess with the development of AI, perhaps... Miku will have an AI and she'll do something very stupid, like sleep with Justin Bieber. But, you know, at least into the foreseeable future, she'll never let you down. And that's kind of, you know, that's what a lot of fans want in a celebrity anyway. They just simply want something that they can relate to, that's reliable and won't let them down, which real life celebrities tend to regret because they're human beings. And welcome back. So, the big controversy, I think it's safe to say, over the last week was when people got their hands on Persona 5, because everybody wanted to play that game, and that's fair enough. It's a great game. So people got their hands on it, and then Atlus went around and explained to everybody that, hey, no, streaming's not cool. Not only has Atlus actually blocked streaming through the share button on the PlayStation 4 controller, but they've also pulled out the embargo statement that they sent out to journalists who got the copy of the game ahead of time and published that as a warning to all streamers as well, basically saying that if you kind of get around the share button and use a third-party device to capture and stream the game and we catch you, you can kiss goodbye to your account. And of course that didn't go down particularly well with the streamers, and unfortunately tainted the game when everybody should be talking about the actual quality of the game, as it is one of the best games, or will be one of the best games of the year. Everybody instead decided to talk about whether streamers should have you know, unlimited access to game content, how publishers should engage with them, and so on and so forth. So, Matt, you have a game out there. What are your thoughts on streamers? Are you cool with them doing whatever they like with your game?
So yeah, like for us, I'm 100% cool with streamers doing whatever they want with our stuff. But you know, that is our stuff. Like you know, we have a very tongue-in-cheek let's play policy, which we actually wrote before this whole thing went down. And yeah, it's kind of like, hey, look, you can do whatever you want, it's fine, we really don't care. But I mean, it's sort of, we've kind of had this explosion of you know, like let's play culture and streaming culture, that is, you know, working with a lot of content that a lot of people have worked on. And you know, I'm not necessarily against a publisher or a developer saying, look, hey, you know, we're cool with you doing this, but you know, hey, can you do us these favors? I think reading over the embargo notes that came out, like, I feel like whoever wrote that was probably in a, you know, between a rock and a hard place in a lot of ways, you know, knowing that it wouldn't go down well, and knowing that you know, that's what their bosses would want. So yeah, I sort of feel for whoever it was who actually had to write that and post it and all of that kind of thing. But yeah, like, you know, I don't think it's there's necessarily anything particularly wrong with it. Just perhaps the execution of the way that message went out was, you know, pretty poor.
Yeah, I mean, I basically agree with you. I think the thing that streamers need to understand is that as far as the publishers are concerned, they are a marketing channel. And that means that a publisher so see that, you know, if with the marketing strategy to let a streamer stream a game, then they're going to shut it down. And that is, as far as I'm concerned, that's kind of, I mean, when Bethesda decided to make that statement about, hey, we're not going to give journalists games ahead of release anymore. And I remember a whole bunch of streamers and YouTubers and whatever, journalists, and going, haha, you know, you're kind of irrelevant now, and you know, we're not journalists, so it's okay for us to still get stuff, you know, ahead of time. And okay, if you want to believe that, then that's your prerogative, but you need to understand then that that is the only reason that you guys streamers and YouTubers differently to game journalists is because they don't see you as journalists, they see you as a marketing channel. And that means that if you don't fit in with their marketing strategy, they're going to leave you out. And that is something you're going to have to accept unless you want to start behaving like journalists, basically. A problem with Atlas deciding that this single player game that is all about, literally all about the story, you know, it might as well be a visual novel. Hey, we don't want streamers, you know, out there giving people into the game for nothing. We want people to go out and actually buy the game to experience the story. Yeah, I'm sure streamers were looking forward to the opportunity to make revenue off Persona 5. But, you know, that just didn't work out this time around. So I think Atlas could have worded it better and certainly managed the community better, but I don't think that there was anything that Atlas did that was wrong in the way that they engaged with the way that they decided to handle streaming with their game.
Yeah, there was a indie game that came out a while ago like just in terms of looking at like how content creators work, there was an indie game that came out a while ago. I think it was That Dragon Cancer. That people who were streaming the game ended up getting copyright strikes, not because they were streaming the game, but because the guy who worked on the music for the game was trying to generate some revenue for himself. Like, the actual production hadn't seen any money come in at that point for how much they had spent on it. And, you know, it's like, it does, you know, while on one hand I can totally understand why it would suck to have your video not be able to be monetized, at the same time, the guy who created that music, you know, would have worked long and hard, and he's probably also, you know, he's equally as deserving of some kind of revenue for his work. Yeah, I think streaming in Let's Play culture in a lot of ways has come a long way very fast, and this is, you know, these challenges that we're beginning to come up against are kind of what's going to shape what that really turns into.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on a very basic level, streamers and Let's Players are quite parasitic in how they use content. And I don't necessarily mean that in a particularly bad way, but it's just a reality that they're not creating that much content themselves. They're adding to existing content, and without that existing content, they have absolutely nothing to work with. That the people creating that original content don't have rights over it doesn't sit well with me. Think that, you know, like you say, this is all very new and it's become very popular very quickly, and, you know, we don't have the legal frameworks for it, we don't have the social frameworks for it, we don't really have best practice, and everybody's still kind of working this stuff out. To kind of rip into Atlas or whatever for having a certain point of view on it is a little bit nonsense, I feel. And I generally kind of sit with the developer or the publisher on this stuff. I think that, yeah, and Nintendo's copped it a lot in the past as well. These guys are the ones making the content. They're the ones that get the final say over how it's used by Let's Plays and YouTubers, I feel.
I'm going to do something I don't often do, Matt, and disagree with you to some extent. and like I agree that obviously it's Atlas's content, and they ultimately they can put in place whatever restrictions they want to because it's theirs, and they need to do what they feel they need to do to protect it. But I do think they have maybe like overstepped quite a lot in terms just with, well, with the way that it's all been handled and worded. But even like I think even for something like Persona or even a straight visual novel, it's quite a different experience watching a stream or a Let's Play and actually playing it yourself. And to the point that even a purely linear story, watching a stream can make you want to play it yourself. And I don't think, I mean, obviously there are some people who feel they can just go and watch a stream and then they've experienced the game and they don't need to play it. But I suspect that they're a bit not, that's not as widespread a view as people think. And that for a lot of people, it's just that the community aspect of kind of like going and watching a movie with your friends. It's that same sort of idea, but game. I think I really like the way that, I know you're not a big fan of their Matt, but Telltale approaches this kind of stuff, because they've got the same sort of, they're facing the same sort of issues with very very story focused games. That they
yeah I mean
embrace like, that streaming more, and they've managed to build whole communities around that. And I think if anything, it gives their games more exposure and potentially more sales.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree that, you know, there is that marketing angle to it. And certainly Telltale is a good example of how a publisher or developer can use that to their advantage. And if it fits in with the marketing strategy, then that's great. You know, there as a resource, and it's great that there are, you know, Let's Players and streamers who are happy to take on that task, I guess, as fans of the developer or publisher. But again, it's kind of vision of the content maker what to do with that content, and if they want a specific marketing strategy which, you know, leaves out Let's Players, then that's, you know, that's their prerogative. We can't force a publisher to adopt a marketing strategy that kind of suits.
I mean, it's their prerogative, but we can also say that, hey, maybe that's wasn't the best idea, and I think that for a game like Persona, embracing that more would have helped the game more than it would have hurt it.
I was just going to say, we talked about, you know, Yakuza benefiting from, you know, people sharing screenshots and Let's Plays and all that kind of stuff. And I certainly, you know, I if I was in charge of Atlas, that would be really funny. But if I was in charge of Atlas, I certainly wouldn't have gone about blocking streamers and threatening them with deactivation of their accounts. But again, you know, in charge of Atlas, and they made their decision. And we kind of... To me, it's important that we respect it. I mean, we also had, you know, last week we had John Kane on, and we were talking about this same thing. And, you know, we mentioned that, you know, there's a good reason that perhaps Atlas didn't want people to be exposed to some of the really heavy content in Persona 5 without, you know, adequate warnings or, you know, this is a game that has themes in it, and you know, if you're on Twitter and someone's sharing screenshots of that, it might upset you, and you know, maybe Atlas is just being mindful of that. So again, we don't know exactly why the marketing team decided to block these things, so you know, we should respect them.
Yeah, I like the there's been a lot of like guessing as to, you know, exactly what the angle is, you know, from everyone who's been covering this. And yeah, I mean, this is the thing. This can turn out to be a really dumb decision. It can turn out to be the one time that this actually happens. But, you know, again, it's up to them to, you know, make that mistake. And you know, if it all goes wrong, it all goes wrong for them. The idea that it's not up to them, I suppose, is what bothers me a lot. It's but you know, whether I think it's the right decision or not, like, you know, I don't care if people stream my game, if you know, if they play the whole thing for 40,000 hours and someone watches it for 40,000 hours, they probably weren't actually going to buy it in a lot of ways, because they're quite happy just watching it. I think, you know, it's up to them. It might be a dumb decision, but yeah.
And welcome back. So for the third little section of our podcast this week, it makes sense to have a chat with the game developer about the game he's developed. Otherwise, it'd be a bit of a waste of everyone's time. So, I mean, Mole Men Must Die is obviously a pretty neat little arcade action game. That's quite cheap. It's about, what is it, $3 on the Steam store or something?
Yeah, we put it out at $3 US.
There we go. So it's nice and cheap and easy to get into. Lots of action. If you're seeing GIFs or video of it, it is lots of action, which means I would probably last about 3 seconds before dying and would then get on and write a very angry review about it. So luckily for you, I wasn't the one that reviewed it. It does, in all seriousness, it looks like it's a lot of fun. It's, you know, one of those leaderboard kind of chaser kind of games. And it's a little bit disappointing, I feel, that we're the only that actually has a review up. I guess that's kind of indicative of how hard it is for, you know, indie devs to really get the kind of that they need to really get their game. So, I mean, is that, you know, would you say that's probably one of the biggest challenges that you've had since, you know, wrapping up on the game, getting some attention for it?
Absolutely. Like, you know, it's the idea of like launching on Steam and just being done with things is kind of, you know, that era has well and truly passed. Like, there used to be a point with Steam where, you know, you could launch your, if you somehow got on the platform, you could launch your little unknown indie game and, you know, be reasonably sure that just, you know, discovery sales would actually, you know, end up, you know, getting you a long way towards breaking even. But, you know, these days it's, you know, just, it's such a process to get your game in front of people, you know, whether it's through like discovery on Steam or into the hands of journalists or into the hands of YouTubers and Let's Players. You know, there are just, there's so much stuff vying for attention now that, it's a process. The idea of, you know, finishing the game and pushing it out, like that's, it's not where it ends.
Yeah, and I mean, it's difficult for us as well. I get, I'd say, about 1,000 emails a day. Maybe not quite that many, but I get enough that my email count just keeps growing. And every time I take a screenshot of my phone, people are like, why aren't you checking your emails? Because there's like 13,000 unread emails on my phone now. And I feel quite terrible because, yeah, especially making stuff for mobile, not so much for Steam for me because I don't generally review Steam games, but you know, everybody knows that I review mobile games. So I get like all these really sweet indie devs saying, hey, I've released a game on you know, phone, can you review it? And I'm just like, I just don't have the time. I don't even have time to respond to a lot of the emails, and I feel terrible about that as well. But yeah, it's just a reality that there's so much stuff being made. Journalists just don't have the time or resources to cover everything they'd want to either. And then you get, you know.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, it's worth saying as well, like, you know, like on the developer side of things, like, yeah, I don't think anyone sort of like takes it particularly personally when, you know, like we don't get picked up by someone or we do, you know, we send off a code to someone and never hear back because it's, yeah, like you just even, you know, I remember the day we launched Mole Men Must Die, there was at least 10 other games launching across that day. And it's just like, you can't sort of get angry at anyone about it because, you know, you're staring at it in the face. Like, you know, that's what's causing it is the, the sheer amount of stuff coming out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, Matt C was on the podcast a year ago in November when we were talking about saturation of games being released and how hard it is to journalists. And that's just at that time of the year, that was just the AAA stuff. You know, you look at stuff like Titanfall, which crashed and bombed because there was games released immediately before and after it. So, you know, when you get to the indie space, you know, that kind of a year, there's not a time that you can actually release a game as an indie and not be competing with a billion other, you know, games at that point in time. It's not just new games either. You know, every week there's a new Humble Bundle sale where, you know, something really good gets thrown out, you know, for like 10 cents. And how do you just, how do you compete with that? You know, it's just $3 is ridiculous for a game, but, you know, people don't see that because they can go and Humble Bundle and get, you know,
10 five, cents. Five games for the, yeah, for the same price.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I'm kind of curious, Matt, you had a particular press release making a lot of jokes about a certain American president.
Yes.
that seemed to kind of go a bit viral, at least from what I could see on Twitter. I saw other people sharing it. Do you think that helped at all?
Yeah, like, sort of that press release was kind of twofold in a lot of ways. Like, you know, part of it was, you know, like, hey, look, here's another angle that we can grab attention from, you know, which, you know, is something that you're always looking for. But the other side of it was, like, I mean, you know, like, while the game is very, you know, tongue-in-cheek, and, you know, doesn't take itself too seriously, you know, underneath all of its arcade gameplay, you know, it's looking at, like, we've spent a lot of time kind of making all our you know, our tongue-in-cheek nature kind of have a little bit of a dark core to it all. So that was kind of nice to just actually be able to talk about it. The PR company that we work with, they sent me over a bunch of questions and were just like, hey, look, just let loose about this whole thing. So I just wrote a whole bunch of stuff. They kind of just, you know, they trimmed it a little bit just to cut out when I was kind of mixing metaphors and things like that. But for the most part, it went out verbatim. And yeah, it was really cool just being able to touch on that side of things and get that in front of people. I'm really glad that we did that.
I've got to ask, when you were starting to develop this game, did you make it, like, I mean, there's no way you could possibly have predicted that it would be so on point when you started to develop the game.
I had no idea that, so we started developing this game in, what was it? Probably like July, maybe last year. Like, the timeline's a little bit blurry, but it was, you know, it's a recently quick game. And at that point, it was about a crazy alternate future brought on by this crazy man on the campaign trail making insane promises that then somehow turned into reality. And, you know, every time, like, something goes down in the news, I'm just sort of like, wow, this game just kind of gets a little bit darker every day, doesn't it?
Yeah, I thought the game was prophetic. Like, I didn't know that it had only started development, you know, in July. And I was thinking, you know, whoever made this game is probably, like, holed up somewhere with a tinfoil hat on, but they've been correct this whole time. Because, I mean, I've seen some trailers, and it feels incredibly on the nose. I mean, not only just the premise, but, like, everything, you know, ranging from the reaction of the, you know, the alternative president, and, like, I mean, the way that the game plays, and, you know, the main, I suppose, object, which is to bomb the ever-living crap out of a group of people. And, I mean, after yesterday's order in terms of what America's now doing to Syria, is just incredibly uncomfortably on the nose, I would say.
Yeah, no, that's 100% it. Like, so, you know, like, just even in my home, like, you know, we you know, keep very on top of what's going on in the news on that front. And yeah, every time, you know, an event like that happens, you know, we just look at, like, a lot of the elements of the game and, yeah, it's quite, you know, like, on one hand, I'm, you know, glad it's out there, but on the other hand, it's like, you know, wow, this is dark.
I've got to ask, given the lack of humor that voters for a certain president have, and given that these people are the kind of people that will kind of hit you with death threats for even saying something slightly unpleasant about a certain president, that as a result of your game being quite obviously, you know, an allusion to this fella?
So we've had like one or two like sort of drive-by comments. So just so you know, I mean, that's people who not drive by my house with the Glock.
Okay, right. I was like, I mean, I know things are a bit crazy in Queensland, but I mean, probably.
just like people who will like see something on social media, rattle off a quick, you know, grumpy comment, and then just keep on going and never come back to the thing. But it was the one person that we actually had put up a serious protest about the game. It actually had nothing to do with the president. We have a female lead in the game, so basically the reason she's in there is I did a whole bunch of character designs. I thought that was the coolest, the end, essentially. But this guy was convinced that the game was actually about trying to kill all men. He was like, you take the molar out of it. What is it all about?
Oh, no.
And he started a Twitter account. You can go look for it. I think it's like Matt's a Feminist on Twitter or something like that. And he was tweeting me, damn you, something like... you know, F you capitalist feminist you. And I was like, wow, I literally just put a girl in with blue hair and that's it. And that's all it took for you.
Cultural Marxist.
Yeah, no, it was really quite this bizarre reaction that, you know, I thought it kind of did the rounds on Facebook for a bit, just as kind of like, wow, that's weird, but you know, okay. We certainly haven't had you know, anything terribly extreme come our way beyond the you know, the odd bit of, you know, like drive-by kind of, you know, heckling and you know, and that guy, but you know, in a lot of ways I think that kind of comes back to the exposure thing. You know, if the game was a bigger deal, you know, I'm sure there would be plenty of people lining up for it.
Mm.
That guy must really hate Miku.
I have actually found his Twitter account, and it says, top tweet, you're a capitalist, feminist, censoring scumbag, Matt. I don't see anything about censoring. Why is censoring the default, you know, derogatory term people want to use?
Like, yeah, not
censoring men.
I come from a background of like community management at EA, and you know, like we've, you know, like I'm quite quite experienced in dealing with you know, the internet, and yeah, and also knowing when to just use your admin powers and not worry too much about you know, when someone has clearly crossed the line. And so I ended up like taking this guy off our forums, and he started complaining to me as if I was Valve, and I was like, no, I'm sorry.
I never understand how people think that they can be as abusive as anything, and then if you ban them, it's like, well, why would you ban me, man?
Yeah, it's a bizarre phenomenon which I just don't understand. But yeah, I've found in community management over the years, like the more you do make it straight out clear that, you know, that sort of thing won't fly, the more reasonable people become quite quickly. Like once you say like, you know, hey, we're not going to be a community like that, people will tend to actually go like, oh, okay, all right, well then, you know, I'll adjust my mode. But until you sort of have that moment, people will sort of tend to let fly a little bit.
Mm.
So Matt, can I assume that your next game will be something just really sort of positive and happy and where everything is fine, just in case it turns out you are actually a prophet?
It is actually something, like, I tend to do this where, you know, I'll make some kind of game that ends up being wildly depressing deep down inside, and then I'll go on and make something completely irrelevant and then repeat the cycle again. So, yeah, I'm not 100% sure what the next game is going to be yet, but it's going to be very colourful and there won't be any politics in it, I suspect.
You have to do a music game starring Hatsune Miku with all Australian music covers. She should just play
Australian music. I really want to do like a dance battle game one day, like essentially GTA, but you take out all the guns and everyone solves their problems with dance battles. Like, I would love that.
That
you
sounds
know,
like
somewhere
the greatest game ever made.
Yeah, I would buy that in an instant. That would be brilliant.
Yeah, something like just something that's a bit less Just Dance, a bit more free. I've seriously put a lot of thought into this. It's on my dream list for one day.
Amazing.